You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. You're listening to Sound Poetry on Radio Tacoma 101.9 FM. And I'm your host, David Gilmore, with Vashon poet Margaret Ronkone, who has been well received by magazines online and published, and has a new book called A Sleeve of Blue from the Goldfish Press in 2022.
So these next three prose poems are personas of three women that just kind of ended up in my imagination. The first one is titled Sophie. She remembers hearing Head for the Hills, maybe an old Western, maybe her father's idea of escape from a bad marriage. When the last of winter's snow turned as drab gray as a business suit, and the returning swallows built nests in the old widow's steepled roof, she packed her rucksack with goat cheese wrapped in parchment, a sewing kit, an old photo of Doris Day. She headed, well, you know where. Wild dogs met her in the foothills. Took her three moon cycles to get her voice tuned to the pack. Marcy laces her shoes with old rawhide, pulls thin arms through her grandfather's worn peacoat. Screen door covered with moth wings slams behind as she sneezes seven times, makes a wish. Checks the hen house for fox tracks, punctured eggs. The lunar cycle marks the tempo of her slow heaven. Every Thursday, 3 a.m., walks the shore of the pond, insomnia gripping like teeth of a mad dog. Water hyacinth brush her bare legs. She remembers the cat lost last spring, how with her nearby she never felt lonely. Marcy speaks Creole. The hills answer with snow. A tree falling in the night, sound of ribs cracking. Evangeline knows black goes well with lace, wishes her legs were as long as Rita Hayworth's. Her women friends think she's shallow, but Evangeline knows the importance of identity. She has dreams of being a trapeze artist, dyeing her hair blonde with pale green stripes. Every morning, she fine combs her lashes until they look like apostrophes, gives her hair 100 strokes with a boar bristle brush, walks to church wearing wet boots. Penance, she mutters four times, crosses herself with pond water. She's content sleeping alone, rubs olive oil along each limb, silk sheets beneath her, head still to prevent wrinkles. Remembers the sound of her mother's old mangle, rechecks the burn scar on her forearm. In the morning, Evangeline brews coffee for one, feigns interest in the New York Times, swallows two diet pills with her OJ. Her neighbor's old pickup, tires watermarked with salt water, has her thinking about leaving. The cellar. Sorting nails at 4 a.m., you find no words to fill baby food jars. Only dialect of metal on metal, a small mouth cap. Your tongue refuses the glue to seal your letter to the outside world. You feed the hissing fire with last year's downed orchard. The slanted porch heaves with gathering rain. This is how one man rules his castle, a moat filled with drowning lovers, waiting the outstretched hand. How easily we bleed under the nail. Katya and Arthur at Sevilla train station. A keyhole of desire is an open bed. They lie in rain, Katya huddled to his heavy frame. They agree to leave in morning, head west to Cadiz. She a student of photography, he of freight trains. A vagabond's web of survival. They brave open roads of blood oranges, eat nothing. His boots strapped with stories, her hair the nest he remembers from childhood. How they clung to the hips of nearby hills, how each desired dust in what it holds, gold, flour, salt, tales of witches who sink to the bottom of the sea. Near the city gates, a pack of boxer dogs. There's a small chance the procession will begin with them.
Read, I'm going to Moscow. Not that Russian themes or motifs are particularly favored today.
No, and this was years and years before the Russian invasion of the Ukraine. Yeah. I'm going to Moscow to trudge through deep snow. I will continue until steeple clocks stop chiming. I will wear scratchy shirts, read Tolstoy, find his orchard, take a bite from a wormy apple, offer the rest to a sleigh driver in a top coat, his red worn hands at the reins of a horse I will steal.
Almost thinking of a novel there when you wrote that one.
I may have been slightly influenced, yes.
Yeah, well, that's wonderful. That concludes the reading of the poems from your book, A Sleeve of Blue by the Goldfish Press, that you can find. What bookstores particularly have you put your book in? Do you know?
Yes, the Vashon Bookshop here on Vashon. The artist is sort of a collective on Vashon. It's called Saw, next to Cafe Luna. That has my books as well. And I believe it's also available through Amazon.
All right. So A Sleeve of Blue, the poems that we've been reading. Now, I know that blue is that color that repeats itself, that shows itself in different hues through your work. I mean, we've got one of cobalt goblets coming a while. But one that I would like, because blue is so frequent as the color that you choose, and of course, what color blue? Many, many blues. But you have one called red. The one called red. Poets often do spend time trying to give the image of red, which is something you can't describe in actual words, but have to use images to do. So it lends itself beautifully to poetry. Red is the one that I thought perhaps might be a good counter at the very end.
Red. Offering pomegranate, you tell me on first meeting, you hoped my face would be a face you could love. I eat the seeds, same jewel red as a tulip's sitting between us, dipping tender layered heads towards the chestnut grain of table. Like deer pausing for drink, unmistakable grace of nature. Swollen, repeated. On the other side of these panes of glass, pine trees scrub the sky. As ravens fly, suddenly perch. Monk robes gathered close, bearing witness to flight. I imagine my bones hollowing, a soft wind sighing through a reed, my glass eyes fixed on the moon, groaning with leftover delight.
Yes, I really love the heads of the tulips there that are likened to deer, the dip of the head.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a very, very fine metamorphosis there.
Thank you.
You would admit to yourself that there are many dreamlike images that appear there. They come in waves at times of dreams, and waves of watery imagery is very strong in your poems. The idea also of navigating by stars.
Yes.
That is also an important one. As so is very many phases of the moon. The way the moon has an effect on natural life. So when you were reading these, did you remember when you wrote them, or did you think as you were reading how these images come and go in your work?
I think the first moment, David, when I began reading each specific poem, I was thinking about when I read it, even though they may have been years ago, or, you know, 5, 7 years. I remember the instance of reading them. I'm very affected by nature and the natural world, and the moon, the cedar trees. To me, there's religion there. There's a holiness. And I find if I now older and I have the time, if I find myself just staring up at the moon in the night sky or walking during the daylight hours in the cedar woods we have here on the island, I feel the closer I get to nature, the more I feel the religion of nature and how it affects me in my work, in my writing.
Navigating by the stars. The archipelago is used often of really things in the night sky, not so much a landform, but it appears with series or lines of trailing stars, perhaps too. So looking at the night sky is a magical, mystical idea for you too, isn't it?
It is. It always has been. It used to be as a child that darkness would bring fear with it because of certain trauma I had. But I find now at this age, having resolved all that, when I'm under the night sky, I just feel blessed to be in that environment. The light of the stars, the light of the moon, it's poetry in itself, David. Just as a human having that experience, to me, it's like a religion. It's actually replaced my religion. I was raised a Catholic, and now I feel that the natural world offers so much more in richness than established religion did to me.
Right. Established religion that is often repeated, especially in the Catholic masses on Sunday. You found a metamorphosis of that into nature, into the mystical life.
Yes.
That appears in nature. You use the term non-religious thinking sometimes, so that the thinking or meditation is not religious, non-religious, that you definitely feel that you have made that translation from that one stage of seeing the religious life or the religious mysticism. You've seen it now in another form and been able to gravitate towards that or elevate yourself, let's say, through the transference.
Exactly. And to me, the natural world is more universal rather than all these sects of different religion that divide people. If only we gave that all up and looked to the natural world for some direction, I think we'd be a healthier human race.
appealing to the scriptures in the various books haven't seemed to have worked very well in being transferred into the human behaviors.
True.
So why do we keep doing that? You know, the repetition isn't what it's cracked up to be. Now we're going to hear a few earlier poems. You go into some of your social life, starting out with the soup kitchen.
And I have to say, the experience that I gained in the soup kitchen is basically, I was very young, I was 17, but what it did for me, it opened up the whole political landscape of what was happening in the world, the inequalities, the prejudices, the sexism. Anyway, it all began in this soup kitchen. So I'll read this. Soup kitchen. In the 60s, I worked in a soup kitchen. My desire to save the world plied with suburban innocence. My robin's egg VW bug stuck out like a sore thumb in the parking lot. No dents, no doors missing. Inside the old building, men lined up, in clothes dirty from street life, stories falling from their mouths where bottles had been. I met my own Mr. Bojangles, never had to request a soft shoe, his eyes blue as a drink. He disappeared one day, never seen again. My hope is he passed from this world with an unspent coin in his pocket.
That last thought, that he would at least have spent the wealth that he had to the full.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
As little of it as there was. Yeah, very, very thoughtful poem with some great, great images there. The old brick building that men lined up in. I mean, these might seem like cliched images, but they still are there in the same way. And the eyes that were as blue as drink, that is a very unusual expression. Of course, you were not going to see that very often, but blue as drink. Yeah, blue coming through there, but the paleness that eyes take on after a life of alcoholism.
Yes.
There's sort of a watering out of the blue.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is kind of a synopsis of my life in a very short poem. It's called Math of a Life. In my second year on Earth, I was stung by a bumblebee. In my 16th, a license to run over yellow lines. In my 21st, my innocence stolen by the whoosh whoosh of sprinklers in the night. In my 25th, pains broke waters and womb. In my 51st, I surrendered my breast to the surgeon's steady knife. In my 71st, I find celebration in branches heavy with fragrant bloom.
Well, you've changed your poem to bring it up to date, haven't you?
Yeah.
You're 71st.
Yeah, yes. You saw it's not yet in there.
Right. Yeah, the benchmarks, the demarcations of one's life. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And the simplicity of things, but surmounting certain obstacles, getting over a bee sting, driving the car, things like that. Yes, well done. You really get top marks for brevity in that one.
Brevity, yes. I'm good at brevity.
Poet who writes about a muse should always have that poem. That poem should be read, I'm sure.
Yes, so I have to say this poem just came out so quickly, and I have to say it's kind of snappy, and I'll try to give it credit with my reading. My muse. She's stuck in 5 o'clock traffic, her patent leather belt cinched one hole short of Barbie's 1963 waist. I'm in the back seat, knees clenched, seatbelt clipped, my head wanting to bob to a Tom Petty tune. Instead, my eyes glued to the back of her head. This muse never got a proper haircut. Her dental reminder cards chucked unread in the recycling bin. Claims she can swallow chicken bones. I tell her, I'm just waiting for a good line. She stops at the 7-Eleven for cigarettes, claims smoking puts her in a quatrain kind of brain. I say, honey, we've never written in form, let alone a quatrain. Says, that's why she switched into unfiltered. I'm considering laying her off, hiring one of those snappy 20-somethings who walks the walk, talks in free verse, has skinny unemployed magicians for friends.
Really good. A contemporary muse. Nothing about those old-fashioned mythological ones. This really is totally up to date.
Yeah, she's a hoot.
Yeah. Well, I hope you have you still have conversations with that muse from time to time. Your poetry seems to have a little more of the lightness of outdoor nature. This one gets right down there with the cigarettes.
3 cobalt goblets, bought thinking consumption could cure a failing marriage. Now sitting on our windowsill, capturing eastern light and dust. Today I wash them, turn them upside down on a towel to dry. Tonight you and I will raise them in a triumphant toast to love without marriage, the unfailing will of the sun to rise, to our mountain in the south, dressing and undressing in her gown of clouds.
Do you still have those goblets?
I have one left. 2 were broken on our move here.
Okay, well, I hope it wasn't that night throwing them, dashing them on stones.
No.
Do you think we need lessons for happiness? Maybe we can get back to that thing called happiness.
Lessons for happiness. Casually dismiss the forecast of snow. If it comes, count the eyelashes on the shelf of his cheek. Put a hold on mail for 6 days. On the 7th, rest. Tap the shoulders of strangers. Tell them you are beautiful. Appear complacent when they turn around. Notice you cast 2 shadows. Be brief with any explanation of gods. 3rd from the left, 2nd shelf, open the book.
Yeah. Your thoughts on writing a poem such as that, you leave with some very open-ended lines or verses. 3rd from the left, 2nd shelf, open the book. Which sort of book did you have in mind when you thought of a book that needed to be opened?
Oh, well, my love is fiction, good fiction, good literature. And I find, despite what's happening in the outside world, if I can get my nose in a book, David, I escape. I can escape just about anything. In my early years, I used to do that. This will date me for certain, but that's okay. Nancy Drew, I was in a Nancy Drew book all the time. And now, as I said, I just look for good fiction. I'll conclude, David, with my grandmother. She affected me so. My grandmother, Annunziata, obviously from Italy. This is titled, In the Hollow Cheeks. in the hollow cheeks of my grandmother, in the stifling house where ghosts stamp muddy feet. My grandfather's baby nail grows like a tongue. He's wearing his beige knit sweater vest, despite the cherry tree's long past gift of red jewels. Up creaky stairs, a mantel clock chimes each hour, reminding him an argument is due. My grandmother, busy with apple pies, boiled potatoes, counts the seconds on her rough red hands.
Ah, we should all remember our grandmothers.
Oh, there's yes.
There's a story in every memory that we have of them.
Yes, and I was blessed with two beautiful, evocative grandmas, yes.
Well, thank you for your evocative poetry throughout the last hour. It was wonderful to have you read so plentifully and to bring up so many images that are part of your life, but also part of your thought life, your dream life, your poetic meanderings of thought, which may be ephemeral at times. But there's one line that I have to ask you about. In the poem in which you talked about the fish and that we are them and that we've changed our lungs for gills, yeah. You also have that intervening line that says, place your knife, the butter knife, on the side of the plate. It comes in there rather rudely, like a command of someone that's spoiling your poetic moment.
Well, David, I have to say that when I read that poem, that short prose poem, and I read that line, I think, why did I put that line in? But then, of course, my poetic brain tries to imagine there was a reasoning. Oh, it's because the flesh is ripe and the knife will be used to cut into the flesh. Of course, I had to find some dark reason.
That's right. But yet it sounds as though it comes in as a total non sequitur.
It is.
And as though you've been disturbed from this wonderful meandering through primitive history. So read once again that short paragraph. Oh, I'd love you to read that through, since we just mentioned it.
Okay. The ocean floor brims with footprints. Once the fish were us, now we are them. Soft lungs replace flapping gills. We lack the magic of stars' navigation. Leave the butter knife at the side of your plate. The flesh is ripe with forgiveness. Dreams of water resolve the fires of night. The shore a distant table, a floating feast.
Thank you. This has been a floating feast, certainly, for a whole hour of minutes.
Well, thank
just
you.
Trickling David. By. Yeah. Well, you have been listening to Sound Poetry, and we've been listening to the poetry, the verse of Margaret Ronconi of Vashon Island. Look for A Sleeve of Blue by Goldfish Press. Thank you, Margaret.
Thank you, David. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.